so you can kill my body. But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say, no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with Eileen Applebaum, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and a fellow at Rutgers University Center for Women and Work. She's here along with her co-author, Rosemary Bott, who is the Alice Hansen Cook Professor of Women and Work at Cornell University School of Industrial and Labor Relations. The two of them together have written a book called Private Equity at Work, When Wall Street Manages Main Street. And in the light of this pandemic and many other very, very intense, what you might call unmaskings of what's taking place in our society and in our economy, I thought it was very important to explore with the two of them who've been INET researchers and at the vanguard of understanding the role of private equity in society in many different contexts. Eileen and Rose, thank you for joining me today. So let's talk about this pandemic, the healthcare emergency, and how the structure of private equity plays a role. It is manifest in, how would I say, what the American people are experiencing, and whether that is a healthy or somewhat demoralizing dimension of the experience that we're having, particularly at a time when the broad base of concern, or what you might call trust and faith and hope, related to expertise and governance, is in flux, is in jeopardy.
So, Rob, thank you so much for that question. And private equity is a fairly complicated investment strategy, and I don't know how much a background the listeners have. So, we won't get too much into the weeds, but we should just say that private equity firms create investment funds in which the investors put in a lot of their wealth. It could be institutional investors or wealthy individuals. And then the private equity firm takes the general partners take control of that investment fund and primarily use it to buy out companies and take them private, using a lot of debt. And by putting so much debt on the company, that often leads to financial distress or bankruptcy. It can lead to poor quality services. It can lead to job loss for workers. And so in the downturn in an economy like we're having right now and like we had in 2008, private equity owned companies may become the most vulnerable in this kind of pandemic. There's a particular concern in healthcare because private equity has moved rapidly into owning healthcare organizations, hospitals, and doctors' practices. And so we want to focus a little bit there today because of the importance of the healthcare sector. And so let me just give a couple of pieces of information before I turn it over to Eileen. But private equity capital investment in healthcare has grown from less than about $5 billion a year in 2000 to $100 billion a year now. And they represent about almost 50% of the mergers and acquisitions in healthcare. And so they are leading a charge towards concentration and consolidation in healthcare in order to gain monopoly power and pricing power that may negatively affect the amount that patients pay. And so what we want to do today is use an example, particularly how private equity firms are buying out doctors' practices and consolidating them, creating a platform and then adding on small physician practices until they build like a national company that then has much more bargaining power in local markets. So the example we want to use is what is called surprise medical billing, that has emerged because private equity firms have been driving the consolidation of physician staffing firms. And these firms are used by hospitals to manage their emergency rooms. And I'm going to turn it over to Eileen to see if she wants to add a few more details on how this actually works.
Well, thank you, Rose. That was a great introduction to private equity in healthcare. And thank you, Rob, for having us here today. What happens is you go to a hospital. It may even be a hospital that's in your network, and you need to go to the emergency room. You fell, you badly bruised yourself, you think a doctor should take a look at you. You go to a hospital that's in your network, and you anticipate that your insurance is going to take care of everything. But it happens that doctors' practices sign separate contracts with the insurance companies, apart from the contract that the hospital has signed. And most of those doctors make sure that they are in the same healthcare networks as the hospital is, so that you don't anticipate that you're going to have a problem. But it turns out that some doctors' practices, especially the ones that are owned by private equity, may not sign a contract with the healthcare insurance company that the hospital has contracts with. So you go to a hospital that's in your network, you're seen by an emergency room doctor, and you leave and you think everything is in order. And then later you get these tremendous bills. So they may be $500 or $600 if it was something small, but they range into the multi-thousands of dollars, with one case that that hit the news circles. It was covered by a lot of news stations, in which an assistant, the surgeon, the hospital is in network, the surgeon is in network, the assistant surgeon is not in network. The doctor charges $133,000 and accepts the $6,000 and change that the insurance company pays, but the assistant surgeon is actually not in network. And that person charges $117,000 and wants the entire $117,000 from the patient. And in fact, the patient has no recourse in that situation. So it can be tremendously expensive, or a little bit more modest, but for poor people or people who are not expecting an unexpected bill of $500 or $1,000, that's a lot of money. So what happened is that this has become a huge problem. Of course, if you are in an auto accident and an ambulance comes, they take you to the nearest emergency room, and then for sure, you may be in big trouble. So what's happened is that private equity, some years ago, noticed that there are all these doctors' practices in hospitals where, in fact, you don't really get to choose your doctor. So you don't get to choose. You probably have chosen your surgeon. You probably have chosen your primary care physician, but you have not chosen the emergency room doctor. You have not chosen the radiologist, and you have not chosen the anesthesiologist. You get there and you're handed a bunch of papers. You sign them. And one of the papers may very well say, this anesthesiologist can bill you separately and is not liable for anything that goes wrong in this surgery. So I train my family to read each and every one of the pieces of paper they give you. And if it says that, just say, sorry, you either give me a doctor in this hospital who accepts my insurance, or you can cancel the surgery. So in any case, what happened is that the private equity companies have bought up the physicians' practices. They begin, as Rose said, with a platform, and the two biggest platforms for doctors' practices are Envision, which is currently owned by KKR, one of the biggest private equity companies in the country, and Team Health, which is owned by Blackstone, which I do believe is the biggest private equity company in the country. And they set up these platforms, and then the platforms go out and buy up doctors' practices. One thing to notice is that all of these transactions are below the radar in the sense that they are small enough in dollar terms that they do not attract the attention of the antitrust regulators. So at the moment, any $90 million will not attract the attention of the antitrust regulators. And so you can buy up doctors' practices for sure for less than $90 million, antitrust doesn't look at you. Now, we have the private equity companies have a problem because nearly all states require that doctors' practices be owned by an organization that is headed by a doctor. So Envision and Team Health, they refer to themselves as management service organizations. They will provide all kinds of management services to the doctor's practices. That's how they advertise themselves. But they have set up a sham organization headed by a doctor that on paper owns the doctor's practices. This is a sham organization because, in fact, the organization that owns the doctor's practices does not own any assets. What does it mean to say you own a doctor's practice if all of the assets of that practice, the technology, the real estate, the chairs in the waiting room, the accounts billable, everything belongs to the management services organization that's providing these management services? So this is essentially a sham. And in fact, people speak of it as Envision owns the doctor's practices. Everybody understands that Envision is calling the shots, or Team Health owns the doctor's practices. But on paper, those doctor's practices are owned by some sham organization that exists only to say, yes, we own the doctor's practices.
Let me ask you, ask a quick question. So these networks of that are under the, which you might call management companies, can have people that are both in and out of network at the same time?
Yes, they can, in fact. And that's how Team Health operates.
Yeah.
Team Health, when it buys a doctor's practice, initially the doctors will be in network. And then Team Health will talk to the insurance company and say, we are going to pull these doctors out of network and have them be able to bill patient the patients you cover separately unless you pay our doctors much more than you pay any other doctors. Typically, they get, on average, they get about 68% above, a premium above what other doctors are paid for the same procedures in the same geographic region. So you pay for the same procedure in the same geographic region, but to the Team Health doctors, if you want to keep them in network, you have to pay a lot more. And every so often, and even though it's a fraction of the cases, it's many, many patients who are affected. So Team Health will take its doctors out of network to make that threat seem real. I mean, to make that threat real, have teeth in it. They do. So Team Health will simultaneously have most of its doctors in network, some doctors out of network, doing this surprise billing in order to enforce the idea that the insurance company should pay Team Health doctors way more than they pay anybody else. And that, of course, jacks up everybody's premiums. That's part of the reason that healthcare costs are rising. Envision, on the other hand, is almost always out of network. They've come under some pressure recently because there's a lot of pushback, a lot of complaints from consumers, and a lot of attention from Congress. And so they have begun to go in network on the same basis as Team Health. Yep, we'll come in network, but you have to pay our doctors more.
Yeah, I think what's really important to emphasize is that the private equity business model itself is driving this. They promise their investors outsized returns. And in order to do that, they've got to bill outsized bills to patients to achieve those returns for their investors. They also load the platform, when we were talking about the building out a platform, the service management company, and the building on the various small doctors' practices into a large network. They buy each one using a lot of debt and loading that debt on the network. And so they've got to service that debt. They've got to manage the cash. And so in Team Health, for example, owes $2.7 billion from its buyout, which occurred in about 2017. And that is due in just 4 years. And Envision owes $5.4 billion due the next year. So they are very concerned about making sure that they service the debt, get outsized returns, and get out of the business in order to make the kind of money that they are promising their investors. So they have been at the forefront of the surprise billing movement, if you will. Not all doctors charge, who are out of network, charge outrageous fees, but the private equity-owned staffing firms, which are have a lot of bargaining power in the market, are the ones that we see doing that. They've cornered about a third of the market, and they employ over 80,000 healthcare professionals taken together. So they have a lot of clout, and surprise medical bills have increased substantially in this period. By one survey, some 41% of Americans report that they or a family member received an unexpected medical bill, half of them attributing it to the out-of-network charges. So this is a serious problem. It's been on the rise. And I think there's enough evidence to point to the fact that Envision and Team Health, owned by the private equity firms, are really the ones driving this practice throughout the country.
So I'd like to add something to what Rose was saying about the debt, just to drive home how important the surprise medical bills are to their ability to manage this huge amount of debt that they put on Envision and on Team Health. With all the complaints that were coming from consumers, the Congress got really involved in this, and they wanted to do something about the surprise medical bills, and they wanted to rein these in. And we can wait a little while to later in this to talk about what the bills look like and how this all worked out. But at the announcement that Congress was going to do something about surprise medical billing, the debt on these companies began trading at a huge discount. Now, remember, Envision is owned by KKR, Team Health by Blackstone. Debt on their companies, because they are such big private equity firms, debt on their companies usually trades at 96 cents on the dollar, 97 cents on the dollar, always in the high 90s. And at the first talk of the fact that perhaps, and this talk, by the way, came last summer. This is when this conversation, Congress became aware of what these bills were. Their constituents were complaining. And at the first talk of the possibility that there would be legislation that would limit this, the the debt of these companies began trading initially in the 80s, which is never heard of for this, and then in the 70s, like 77 cents on the dollar. And that is distressed debt territory. That is already, you're in trouble with your debt. If people are willing to sell it at 77 cents on the dollar just to get rid of it because they don't think you're going to be able to meet the debt payments in the end when they come due in 2024, this is just unheard of for debt that's on companies owned by Blackstone and KKR. So this ability to do the surprise medical billing is hugely important to the private equity business model for these doctor practices that are in hospitals.
Right. And I also want to add another area that private equity is really involved in and where surprise billing is very prevalent is in emergency ambulances, particularly air ambulances. So for example, in this sector now has three large mega companies. Three airport air transport companies control about two-thirds of the U.S. market. Two of the three are private equity owned. One of them, what is called Air Medical Group Holdings, is owned by KKR as well. So KKR owns Envision. It also owns this air transport company. And then another is owned by another private equity firm. The surprise medical bills under air ambulances have just skyrocketed in recent years since private equity takeovers. And it's a particularly lucrative area because the demand is what we call inelastic. If you need the ambulance, you need it. And so there's no kind of competitive market pricing. And so these air ambulances can charge thousands of dollars per incident. And it's particularly serious in rural areas and small towns because with the stress on hospital systems, we know that rural hospitals have been closing. And so patients need to be air-vacked to the nearest medical center or hospital, which can be, you know, hundreds of miles away. And so this area has gotten very, very serious. And we expect it to continue because the, post-COVID, who knows how many hospitals will continue to do well, but the rural hospitals, small town hospitals will continue to be very, very hard hit. And we expect a high level of consolidation to be going on there as well.
I'm a little bit spellbound right now as I'm listening to the two of you. And the reason for that is that I was unaware of these systemic structural phenomena. But in my own life, I had a primary care physician that I was very fond of, and he had been very good to me. And then his practice was purchased, and he joined a group in another part of Manhattan. And they provided me with documents that asked me to sign off on their ability to pick out anybody. And I happened to read the documents, and the notion of in or out of network, et cetera, was at their discretion. By total coincidence, that morning, I had read a story in a major newspaper about how high net worth individuals had to be afraid because they could all afford to pay, and high net worth individuals would therefore be targeted for out of network, particularly anesthesiologists, and they cited a number of lawsuits. When I brought this awareness to my physician and told him I wouldn't sign the clauses that gave them that license, he was quite unsettled, but within a couple of days told me that he would no longer be my physician and I had to move onward, which I regretted because, like I said, I thought he had provided me very, very lovely interactions responsive and a deep insight into my health for several years. But that's what ruptured the relationship.
Yes.
I mean, that's really not so surprising. I also have an eye doctor practice that I see, very successful, prime target for private equity. And they did meet with the private equity people, and they chose not to go be purchased by private equity because they would lose complete control, just as you were mentioning, they would lose complete control over the billing practices. And the practice that I go to, if your insurance doesn't cover their procedures, they will accept the Medicaid fee, which is way less than even private insurance will pay. And if you're too poor to afford that, they will take care of you for free for whatever you could afford to pay. As my doctor said, I am not allowing somebody to go blind just because they don't have enough money to pay me. We have a very well-run practice here. We have lots of paying patients. We can afford to take care of people who cannot afford to pay us the full freight. And that was their reason for not going. So there are some admirable doctor's practices out there. But once he joined that practice that was owned by private equity, as a doctor, he can decide how to treat you, but he has no control over anything else that the doctor's practice does.
Yeah, and what I would add is that I think it's, we've been following the healthcare journals, and even though we're not, healthcare professionals ourselves, but there has been increasing discussion in these journals about the prevalence of private equity moving into all sorts of specialties. So we've talked a lot about emergency room physicians, and of course that includes specialists like radiologists and anesthesiologists, but they're moving into dentistry, ophthalmology, orthopedics, every type of specialty where they see that there is a large margin. So where they see that they can make they would call value added payments because a procedure may be somewhat complex, they will go and target those kind of more profitable niches in medicine. So they're peeling off the various specialties and rolling them up. And so the example we gave you of emergency rooms is very kind of a model that they're now taking into these other practices. And, for doctors, we've read testimonies that where the doctors say, we thought it was a good idea because we don't, specialize in billing and accounting and administration. So we thought it was a good idea to turn it over to somebody who would be so-called professional in managing the kind of business end of the practice, not understanding, at least initially, what they were really getting into. So I think there is a growing awareness among doctors that they have to be very, very wary of private equity. And hopefully these kinds of conversations that we're having will provide education and awareness to the medical profession as a whole.
Yes. So Rose is right. They are moving out of hospitals and into these other specialties. The difference is they have to make their money in a different way. As Rose said, they pick the high margin ones to begin with. That's certainly true. They locate their offices in the higher income communities. I just read an article about the buying up of the dermatology practices. They buy up practices that are located in areas that have average income way above the average income in the country as a whole. So that is a big part of how they make their money. The other big part is because it's not an emergency and you are free to choose a different doctor, they're not going to do the out-of-network piece and the surprise billing. But what they do is put tremendous pressure on those doctors to be productive. They call it, they measure their productivity. And to be productive, what you see sometimes is that doctors will now order tests that are unnecessary, that you have no idea whether they were necessary or not. You go to see the doctor, you have a mole, You want to know if it's cancerous. The doctor says to you, well, I've seen a lot of these, and I'm 99% sure it's not cancerous. But just to be positive, I'll take a biopsy. We'll send it out to the lab, and we'll find out. And what you don't know as the patient is whether that biopsy was really necessary. As the patient, you're saying, yes, please, take the biopsy. 99% is not good enough for me. I want to be 100% sure. But it may be that the doctor really knew that that was not cancer, but call for the biopsy anyway. You'll never know. And so there have been some court cases, again, as has been said, that have revealed that in some cases there were unnecessary procedures. There are also scheduling way more patients than it's reasonable for the doctor to see as another way to raising their productivity. So that comes with a whole set of other problems. Definitely, you don't want private equity owning doctors' practices. It's not a good thing, either financially or for the patient. But if we want to get back to the surprise medical bills, Rose, do you want to lay out what the difference is between the two of them, and then I'll talk a little bit about the politics?
So over the last year, there's been debate in Congress over what kind of legislation should be passed. And there is broad bipartisan support for passing a bill, and that's because, you know, some three-quarters of Americans in various surveys have showed that they really want national legislation on surprise medical bills. That is because while there are some states that have legislation covering protecting some patients, these laws do not cover the self-insured employer plans, and which can only be regulated by the federal government. And some 61, almost two-thirds of patients would not be covered under these state bills. So we need federal legislation. And there are two approaches that have been put forth. The one is that you would pay out-of-network doctors a rate that is benchmarked to rates negotiated within network doctors. So it could be the median of in-network payments for a service in a given local market, or perhaps 125% of the Medicare payment. Now, that is an approach that has been supported by most insurance companies, hospitals, and that would really keep costs down. The other approach that is really been sponsored by the private equity firms with lots of lobbying that Eileen can talk about, this would allow the doctors to seek a higher fee, a fee that is higher than the benchmark, via an arbitration process. So that just opens up a can of worms. Obviously, any doctor, most doctors would just go for an arbitration to see if they can get more money. It would be long and drawn out, the transactions costs high, and it would lead to a higher rate of increase in healthcare bills. So those are the two approaches, and private equity firms have been the ones behind lobbying for the second approach. And Eileen, maybe you can talk a little bit more about that.
So what happened last summer is that everybody became aware that it was mainly Team Health and Envision that were really raising medical costs, healthcare costs through what they were doing, and that were hitting unsuspecting patients with these high out-of-network charges. So that was known by the summer. There was an initial bill in the House that by Frank Pallone, Frank Pallone's committee, that called for the second approach where it would be benchmarked. Then there was an initial round of lobbying to say, well, we need arbitration. And Pallone understood on his own why that was not a good idea. But under the pressure and in the effort to get something passed, did provide for arbitration in certain cases, certain limited cases where it might makes sense. So it was no longer the most wonderful bill that consumers could have, but it was a pretty good bill. And it was around that time that the report that Rose and I did for iNet became public, and that we wrote some op-eds pointing out that Envision and Team Health were owned by private equity companies. These are not just freestanding big deal doctor's practices, they're owned by private equity. And this really created a backlash in Congress. They had really, people in Congress were not aware, as most of the public is not aware, that private equity is behind this. And they were very unhappy. The Loans Committee and especially was unhappy and asked for, sent letters with requests for information from KKR and from Blackstone and Envision and Team Health. All they ever got was the sort of PR fluff, no real answers to their questions. And meanwhile, over in the Senate, where who knew that there was going to be equally strong feeling, a committee headed by Lamar Alexander, of course, who's a Republican, also got involved in this, and they put together an excellent, excellent bill to protect consumers and hold down healthcare costs. It even included the ambulances, the air, I guess the ground ambulance. Air ambulance is regulated as airplanes are regulated. So you have to have a ruling from the FTC. But in the meantime, it was a very good bill in the House. Now that you have the good bills in the House, and this is when private equity goes into overdrive. There was an initial smaller group that put up, $2 million or something like that. At the time that Rose and I were writing about private equity, they had already spent $28 million. And by the time they finished, they spent $58 million trying to prevent the passage of the bills, the House and Senate bills, which by the time of the fall, they had a joint bill between the two houses. So there was no question, and given the leadership on it, there was no question that if it was brought up for a vote, it would pass. And I always like to kid around and say, if I'm asked about this, they had 58 million. Rose and I had a little under 50,000 from iNet. But the research we were able to do and the our ability to make clear what was going on behind the scenes is really what armed the members of Congress to figure out what they needed to do. We didn't lobby them. I didn't meet with Pallone, and neither did Rose. We didn't meet with Lamar Alexander. But the work that we did was circulated to them and to many members of Congress. So these were really good bills. And by the fall, they had this joint bill, and it was all set to go into that end of the year resolution that they had in December, where they passed a number of proposals that were really critical to the economy. And this was supposed to be one of them. And at the very last minute, Richard Neal in the House of Representatives from Massachusetts, who heads the House Ways and Means Committee, and therefore has a tiny little piece of what could go into the surprise medical legislation. He hadn't said a word. This has been going on since June, and he had not said a word until it was about to be put into this bill in December, at which time he introduced his own bill, which he claims is a wonderful bill for reining in the excesses of private equity. And of course, it would do no such thing. It's absolutely have no effect on surprise medical bills, although he pretends that it will. And now there are two bills in the House, and either they need to be reconciled, or the Speaker of the House has to say, we are going with the Pallone bill. Well, she did not say we are going with the Pallone bill. She said, okay, let's wait and see if these two bills can be reconciled. And of course, that was the end of it at that time. And they haven't been reconciled. Richard Neal's continued. He's running. He's in a primary, and he's running on how great he's going to be about reining in surprise medical bills with this piece of legislation that, if you read it, does nothing of the kind. So that's where we stand in terms of reining it in. There's still tremendous support in both houses of Congress for this. And who knows in the next Congress whether we will be able to make progress. But in the meantime, the debt of Envision, which is the one that has mostly the surprise medical bills, there's apparently in the credit markets, there's a general belief that, in fact, legislation to rein in surprise bills will pass in the not certainly before 2024. And too many people wanted to sell that debt at a discount. It was creating tremendous problems for Envision and KKR. And so they engaged in a process that Rose and I, in our book, refer to as pretend and extend. Pretend that if you extend the loans, they will figure out how to pay it off. And so Envision has had to offer loans that will, some part of those loans will not come due until after 2024, but they will pay a much higher rate of interest. And so to get that much higher rate of interest, they were able to get enough owners of their debt to agree to exchange the debt that was due in 2024 for this much higher interest paying debt that will come due years later, by which time Envision hopes to have things enough under control that it will be able to pay off that debt. So that's where we are in terms of the ability of Congress to move legislation. And of course, Rose and I are watching the primary in Massachusetts. Richard Neal is pretty formidable. He'll probably win his primary, but should he lose, then I think there's a very good chance that the next Congress will, in fact, pass legislation to rein in surprise medical bills and to rein in the ability of Team Health, which doesn't use that so much, to extort the insurance company to get higher payments.
Right. And I want to just make a couple comments about the situation during this COVID pandemic. We mentioned earlier that the surprise medical bills for COVID-related illnesses have been suspended. But what is also clear is that private equity firms are kind of waiting in the wings to take advantage of the post-COVID period. They're actually also taking advantage of the current COVID bailouts. So despite the fact that, Envision and Team Health both have started cutting doctor salaries and doing some furloughs very early on, they nonetheless have gone after bailouts. And we've been tracking Envision, which with an incomplete accounting so far has gotten at least $109 million, of which $54 million went to the KKR air and ground ambulance companies. And so the full accounting will include the smaller loans that we have not completely analyzed yet. So here you have this contradiction, right, where you look at KKR and the two of the founders, Henry Kravis and George Roberts, together have about $11 billion in what they own, their net worth. And yet here they are going to the government to get taxpayers to bail out a healthcare company that they themselves have run into the ground. So that's the kind of contradictions we see in a period like this, when there is such massive suffering and private equity firms are either in other sectors, they're either going bankrupt and then walking away from things, or they are waiting get bailouts. And they also continue to sit on millions and millions of dollars, $1 trillion in what we call dry powder, which is uninvested capital, that they will not use to help their buyout companies, and which they will use to buy out organizations on the cheap as we come out of this great recession.
Yeah, let me just correct one misstatement. It's not the ambulance companies that they got the $54 billion for. They're surgery centers. So KKR through Envision owns a bunch of surgery centers. And you might remember that these were closed completely during the peak of the COVID crisis. And so that's where they got the $54
billion. So let me ask, as this crisis emphasizes the, what you might call, inadequacies of our healthcare system, and brings us, what you might call, to the zoom lens or the unmasking of what's taking place. It feels like to me that I worked for 6 years in the United States Senate, that what people used to do kind of off stage in the weeds, which wasn't really public policy, but was designed to fill the war chest for campaign re-election. You would imagine now that a floodlight, if you will, would be shining on the health sector. Is this, am I incorrect about that, number one? And number two, is this a time when proper legislation, proper response to the kind of refracted healthcare system and the gaming of costs could be remedied?
So it looks like it's a possibility, but you're exactly right. Richie Neal was actually a cheap date. He got money from Blackstone in the quarter that ended in September. So over the summer that this was all going on, really a meager amount, $27,000. You would think they could do better. But other people, other members of Congress who are on these committees who are not going to be supportive of this legislation, they announced that they were not going to be supportive of it, and in the hopes that they would get money from the lobbyists for the private equity firms. So definitely that is going on to try to scuttle this. But from what we've seen, there's so much interest in Congress, if they can get it through the two houses, in reining in these bad treatment of patients when they're most vulnerable. They have enough to worry about with getting over their illness or their injury, not to have to also worry about how they're going to pay these huge, huge, unwarranted medical bills. So I think that it's really going to depend on whether some of the key people in Congress can either be persuaded or overruled, whether we're actually going to get something out of it. Private equity is just getting stronger and stronger. You know, in much of Europe, they put a pause on mergers and acquisitions, and they did it precisely so that private equity could not come in and buy up at fire sale prices companies that would in the future be able to recover. We don't have any such pause in this country. And we are going to have a lot of doctors' practices, especially those where it's a young doctor starting out, that are going to be in serious financial trouble. The main relief that those young doctors can get is from the Paycheck Protection Program, the PPP. And this program provides money that can be spent on payroll to maintain employment. It also can be spent on rent, interest on a mortgage if you have one, and utilities. And that's all. You'll notice you cannot be paying off any equipment that you might have bought to equip your doctor's office with. So if you are a young doctor or a young practice and you have bought up all the equipment you need to be technologically capable of providing the best care to your patients, you probably have a lot of debt, which made a lot of sense when it looked like you were going to have patients coming in, but it doesn't make any sense right now when mostly you've been closed for a while and now you're open, but a lot of people don't want to come into doctor's offices. So you're not making the money that you could have, and the bailout money cannot be spent on making payments, either interest or principal payments, on technology equipment, things like that. So they're going to have a lot of these doctor's practices that the doctors will face a choice between going out of business or selling themselves to private equity. At least, as Rose and I have talked to some consultants, that's what the private equity companies believe is going to happen. And they are just waiting, waiting, waiting to pounce on these young doctors' practices that are starting out, fully equipped with modern technology, unable to pay the bills, and facing an extremely difficult situation.
Rose, do you see light at the end of the tunnel here, or do you think that this, perpetual turmoil in the role of money in politics and the concentrated power of private equity will inhibit proper reform?
Well, what I'm concerned about is I'm concerned that both parties have many supporters who are private equity firm owners, hedge fund owners, Wall Street elites. And so even a change of venue to a Democratic presidency does not necessarily guarantee that there will be the political will to rein in the financial elites. And we saw this after the 2008 financial crisis. And there are some, clearly, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, there are some, an increasingly AOC and increasingly a small number of people who really get it. But there are a lot of people who don't. And for example, if we talk to pension fund leaders and managers who we have shown in our studies, the private equity actually doesn't beat the stock market. That it doesn't, at the median fund, the typical fund does not beat the stock market, and that returns have been declining for over a decade, more than a decade. And despite the fact that you show all of this evidence, there is this continued belief that, well, oh, these guys are really smart, they know what they're doing. And so I think the ability to take on Wall Street actors, such as private equity firms, is very, very difficult and constrained in the U.S. context. We'll see.
Well, I think, how would I say, with all of the different dimensions of distress in our economy and the suspicion that was aroused after 2007 and 2008, where, as Joe Stiglitz often said, the polluters got paid and the people underwater with mortgages, which is a broad base of the public, did not get support. That we have a crisis right now of what I will call faith in expertise, faith in governance, and it, I fear, makes the body politic more susceptible to demagoguery and authoritarian promises. Because these kinds of scenarios and experiences that you're citing today do not create a, what you might call, a faith in a shift from unfettered free markets to a more mixed system such as we had during the Roosevelt New Deal. And I remember there was a gentleman in 2011 who talked about how the Obama administration did not feel that they could resort to the New Deal energy because things like the Gallup polls showed that there was a great deal of cynicism, even among Democrats, about the capacity of government to do good. And the resulting which you might call deep dive into the Gallup polls, was that their concern or their skepticism was related to feeling that government was captured by private interests and the government was doing it to them, not for them. I wonder if you, either of you, have final thoughts on how we can move beyond this quagmire and go to a healthier place and a better balanced system than currently exists in the United States.
I think you're right. And I think that since 2011, in fact, since 2016, there has been a concerted effort to undermine people's confidence in what government can do. The attack, my view of the attack on the Affordable Care Act is that that was an example of how government could help you. And they want that to go away because they want to say, no, government can't help you. You have to rely on the private sector. It's not the old free market, even in the private sector, because the old free market was you had a lot of companies out there. They were competing with each other, whatever, delivering quality services and goods. But nowadays, most of our industries are dominated by a couple of companies or financial interests. We saw it with the Affordable Care Act. We're seeing it right now with the post office. They want to privatize the post office. Nobody ever wanted to see a privatized post office. This is a government agency that almost everybody in the country, A, loves it, and B, has confidence in it because every day it delivers your mail. So you see for yourself, it's doing its job. We can see before our very eyes what it is they're doing to undermine confidence in the post office. Really, I think that if the Democrats should succeed in taking back the presidency, and if they control both houses, and as Rose said, we see plenty of bad behavior by Democrats, but if they do, and if they can put forward bold programs, I think that's the only way to go, to say, well, the Gallup poll says they don't have confidence or cynical, therefore we should do less. That didn't work. We tried that. That didn't work. I think that on the issues that people care about, on climate, on healthcare, they need to really be bold and say, yes, we're the government, and yes, we can do this. I think that'll make a huge difference.
Yeah, I think there are some really interesting proposals for a national investment authority that would pick up on some of what the New Deal did, but in a more comprehensive way. I think that a positive response will depend in part on, you know, how long the COVID pandemic wreaks havoc in our economy, how desperate people get, and the government will be the funder of last resort and the place where people will have to turn if they are going to see their livelihoods maintained, get some kind of unemployment insurance, avoid evictions from their housing, et cetera. So I think Aline is right that it will depend a lot on getting control of both houses as well as the presidency.
Well, we don't end on an note of optimism, but I think the quality and the depth and the texture of the understanding of these, how would I say, painful outcomes that you've shared with us today is very valuable. And I know that the health sector will be very central, whoever wins the presidential election, in how we evolve our society, and as I mentioned, the faith and trust in expertise and governance. It is the case that there are many other countries within the OECD who have healthcare results that are much more favorable than the United States at a fraction of what our citizens pay per capita for healthcare. So this is not purely some romantic vision. This is about adopting a, what you might call, a better system that's already been proven. But for today, I would like to say thank you on behalf of myself and our audience to each of you, not only for our conversation today, but for all the work you do and have done for INET and to illuminate the things that are happening in this world. And I do hope that you'll come back and join me for another episode and after the election time, when we might be able to share what you might call a visionary exploration of what the next administration should prioritize in the realm of private equity and the health of our citizens. Thank you both.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Yeah, thanks for having us. We'll be happy to come back again.
Excellent. Excellent. I look forward to that. Bye-bye. And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.